to Kent Biz Connect, the show that connects businesses in Kent to do business. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another bi-weekly Kent Biz Connect radio show coming live from the fabulous Kent Space studio here in Ashford with myself, Martin White.
And me, Brian Wakefield.
Brian, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Martin.
On this horribly rainy day, I think everybody's getting thoroughly fed up with this very unseasonably early autumn weather that we're having, this kind of November weather that we're having in what should be a nice sunny October still. But hey-ho, we shall try and put a smile on everybody's face today.
Yeah, I think that's within our remit to do that. But yeah, it's been a bit damp and grey out there, isn't it?
Damp and grey indeed.
We've only got another 3 weeks of it before it snows. So.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, before you go on holiday to Cyprus,
and that, yes.
You won't have to worry about it.
No, I won't.
But to help us put a smile on everybody's face today,
the important people,
we've got some fabulous studio guests with us. So to my right, please introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Neil Page. I'm a director of Horizon Vehicle Leasing. We're a vehicle broker, but I'm also the chairman of the Active Business Group, which is based in Faversham.
Neil, welcome to the show.
You.
Great to have you here.
Welcome, Neil. And to my left...
Hello, I'm Simon Morgan from the HR department, and my company helps small employers with all aspects of employment.
Simon, welcome to the studio. Mm. I know both of you are sort of experienced radio show guests, having been on before, but it's lovely to have you, and we look forward to kind of catching up with you in about 20-25 minutes or so. But I think what we'll do is we'll kind of kickstart the show with some topical kind of Kent business news, Brian. What's going on out there?
Yeah, there's a few bits and pieces that have caught my eye over the last week or so. There's a major report that's coming out regarding Kent. So it's been put together by Locating Kent and Visit Kent. There's basically a huge shortage of hotels in Kent. Was we aware of that? So much so, really, that the demand for Airbnb properties in some coastal areas has risen by 450%. And there's a few interesting snippets that have come out of it. This is purely on business hotel rooms, but Canterbury needs just shy of 500,000 business bed nights per year. So that's the biggest in the county. It's a lot of rooms, that, isn't it?
Gosh, that's just in Canterbury.
That's just in Canterbury.
No wonder they got traffic problems.
Yeah, I know. That's why, yeah, you need a bypass there to bypass the whole place, really. But it's a nightmare, isn't it? Maidstone, unsurprisingly, is second, 301,000. And thirdly, which did surprise me, but you may elaborate on this, Martin, being the East Kent expert, third place is Thanet. Mm. And they need around 250,000 business rooms. So the economy, the Kent visitor economy, has actually grown by over £1 billion over the last decade, about 9%. Year on year. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
What do we think that's down to, guys? I mean, I'll open this up. Is that the sort of the staycation kind of economy that we're in now? Are more and more people taking their holidays, taking advantage of our beautiful sort of seaside towns and stuff? What do we think's going on there? Why have we got all this sudden demand for hotel rooms?
I don't know, really. It's not one, isn't it? I mean, it could be, you say, that sort of staycation, but it all could be, you know, business people that are looking to... I mean, they do more things in the southeast now, sort of the construction expo, which was on a couple of weeks ago, and this sort of thing. So whether those sort of things are people need places to stay overnight, events, that type of thing, you know, business sort of does grows in Kent.
Mm. Simon, what do you think? Are you a kind of a seasider? Do you like to pop down there at weekends and stay overnight, or...?
No, not really.
No.
I haven't got time to do that. But I could certainly think that the Kent coast is a very nice place to visit. Mm. And the transport links are much better now, aren't they, as well, with the high-speed trains, etc.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think probably more people are going to the coast for weekends and short stays as opposed to, you know, long holidays, which may account for the reason why there's more demand for hotel rooms, etc.
Yeah. I suppose the interesting is the demand for sort of lower quality or higher quality. You know, we're looking at sort of five-star end or the, you know, more budget end or something. Depending on, do they sort of state whether that's the case?
Well, they do. The full report's going to be available probably in another month, 6 weeks, something like that. And it goes a little bit deeper where they look at at the level, the standard of accommodation, and there's not enough five-star accommodation in Kent, and there's not enough larger units, really.
Right. So budget stuff, more budget and top-end
stuff.
So it's across the board then, isn't it?
Well, there's such an alarmingly small percentage now of five-star accommodation, and that has, say, larger than 60 rooms. Mm. So they're all much, much smaller, so consequently they get filled up very quickly. But one of the interesting things on this is that, we've mentioned about people holidaying and staycations and stuff. So in respect of places like Ramsgate and Folkestone, their numbers have kind of gone through the roof, but they're attributed really to kind of visitors. But purely on business, it was Canterbury, Maidstone and Thanet.
Makes sense.
So what's your...
I don't know about Thanet on business.
So Thanet, I was going to ask you that. Obviously, we've got Discovery Park.
Well, we had Discovery Park, didn't we, in the studio a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And they, funnily enough, are in the process of... They've just sold some of their land down at Sandwich for a new holiday inn to go in. So I'm not quite sure how many rooms that's going to have, but they've obviously identified that, and Holiday Inn have identified that as a sort of a growing need locally, which is why they're kind of sticking a new hotel up in record time. I think they're trying to get that ready for the Open Championship next summer. So
so what's been going on in Thanet that's created this huge demand then?
I don't know. I guess places like Discovery Park, which are more kind of generic business parks now, rather than focused on a particular kind of pharmaceutical sector, which is what they used to be, are certainly kind of attracting new businesses in all the time. If you're coming there, somewhere like that on a conference, you need somewhere to stay. And there just isn't necessarily, the vacancy, the room kind of vacancy that you need locally. So I guess it's just a general trend, isn't it? I mean, whenever you drive on the roads these days, they're busier. Whenever you try and take a holiday, the flights are busier. Mm. I would imagine this is all just part of the kind of the general southeast kind of economy that we live in, which is kind of continuing to grow, and we need to kind of keep pace with it. And it doesn't matter whether it's kind of hotel rooms or road networks, with the infrastructure just isn't there, is it? And we need to upscale it fairly quickly.
I think it's fair to say there has been an increase in hotel rooms with chains like Holiday Inn, Holiday Inn Express, Premier Inn, Travel Lodge. They've been expanding.
Yeah.
Travel Lodge was in the top 250 companies in the Sunday Times the other day. I mean, they obviously have a particular type of business model, and you know what you're getting with those sorts of places. I think it's more difficult for the independents, isn't it? That it's a tough business to be in, and I'm wondering if as many people are actually, wanting to try and make a living out of something like that.
So perhaps some have gone to the wall,
but equally you get the sort of, you say about the five demand for the five-star hotels. It's that kind of niche, smaller hotels, and a few of them around, which I think, as you say, those are the ones that are getting busy because people want that kind of quality.
Yeah.
And if they're getting booked up, maybe we need more, as you say, more of that sort of, but it's that sort of, that's something a bit different, based in a castle or an old lodge or something like that, which I guess you say they can't expand in terms of the room size, it's a number of rooms, but equally those are sort of in demand because they're sort of things that people like to visit.
Mm. Well, it's certainly interesting. Mm. Certainly interesting. You mentioned another word or another brand, Airbnb, and, I think the danger is that, we've seen it in big cities like Barcelona and places like that where the demand for, holiday rooms has kind of far outstripped supply, and private landlords have basically put all of their stock on Airbnb for tourists to kind of book and take advantage of at the cost of local people.
Does that mean there's nowhere for people to live anymore?
Exactly.
Then? Okay.
And that's exactly what's happened in Barcelona. It's become so popular that, local people are up in arms because they can't afford the rents anymore because they can't pay Airbnb rates. No. They want long-term rentals, at reasonable kind of rates. They're not paying tourist rates to rent a room in, in Barcelona. So,
because your 30 days a month is probably going to equate to, I don't know, $3,500-$4,000 a month, and people can't and won't pay that kind of rent, should be, you know, less than half of that.
So I think it brings its own kind of unique set of problems with it, doesn't it, when the demand kind of outstrips the supply. So, so yeah, we need to build more hotels and kind of fill that, you know, create some new capacity in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I don't know, and none of us know what's going to happen as of the 1st of November. So I mentioned that without actually mentioning the word, didn't I? So on the 1st of November onwards, what impact is that going to have? Because as some people have you believe, it's going to take you 6 or 8 hours to get in and out of England and France and everything else. I'm sure that's not the case. But to make a point, is are people going to be saying, well, yeah, I ordinarily would have come over on business in one day. Now I'm not going to do it. It's a bit more of an ordeal. So I want to be staying for 2 or 3 days and doing everything in one hit. Right, so they're going to want somewhere to stay. So is that going to
create more of
up?
A problem?
So it's a possibility,
knows?
Isn't it?
Who knows? Anyway, let's move on. What else have you got? I've been looking at something here. It says Kent to get 320,000 new fruit trees.
Ah, now that is interesting. Yeah, I saw that and I thought, is there a link? What's the relevance of it? And it's nice to get the fruit. But another little story in the news this week is Nim's Crisps, I think based in Sittingbourne. And they're bringing out this this new range of child-friendly, healthy kind of crisps that are not oiled and fried and made of fruit.
They're air-dried rather than fried.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's got to be good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So air-dried crisps with fruit in them. So yes. Are they still crisps? I'm not sure.
Well, they're fruit crisps.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They do vegetable crisps as well.
Do they?
Yes.
There's a concept.
Parsnips and all that kind of stuff.
A little bag of salt that you shake on? Maybe not. But
possibly.
Sure. So that's a good thing. So, yeah, it's quite sugary. Yeah, another silent killer. I think that leads us on to one or two other bits and pieces, really, because, and you will know more about this, Martin, but they're going to be going for locally sourced kind of fruit and stuff like that. So there's the link to all these thousands of fruit trees.
Yeah.
And,
what a wonderful sort of business success story, you know. I mean, with the kind of the... You know, I
good for the environment, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it's good all round, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, you think about the sort of the poor, much berated sort of humble apple orchard, you know, which is, you know, we are the garden of England. And I think that they're sort of they're fruit trees generally, I think, and fruit is having a new lease of life, isn't it? And, you know, people are much more conscious about where their food comes from today, you know, and what the kind of carbon miles attached to a kiwi fruit are, and do you even need to eat a flipping kiwi fruit, you know, in the middle of winter, when, you know, we've got apples in storage, for example. And I think Nims have just kind of jumped on that and said, look, you know, we have got a ready supply of fabulous produce in Kent, that we can store and we can overwinter and that we can just take out of storage and we can kind of put to good use when we need to on a kind of, on a crisp production basis. And it's all grown locally. And we can make a fantastic product and we can, you know, transport that to kind of local supermarkets, and you know, make a good living out of it. So it's
a bit of a win-win, isn't it, really?
I think
healthy
it is.
Food,
yeah.
And
it's a really good news
economy.
Story, that, isn't it? And I think that, you know, that I think they're probably, they're certainly Kent's largest, fruit producer, Gotham and Son, are planting, I think on the back of that, I saw somewhere that they're planting, you know, thousands of new trees, as we
did
said.
Did I see a figure of 300,000?
Well, that's what we were just saying, 320,000 new trees that they're going to be planting.
That's a lot
so,
of trees.
Yeah, so they obviously see the future in it as well. But I want to bring Simon in.
Is he a big fruit crisp eater then, Simon?
I think...
I will be after this conversation.
I think traditionally, you know, that kind of, that industry has been reliant on kind of foreign labour, hasn't it? You know, people to pick the apples, for example. And I know, you know, farming is becoming ever more kind of rationalised in terms of the whole kind of production process. But We can't necessarily call on that labour anymore, can we?
So you still need seasonal workforce, don't you, really, to come in and actually pick the fruit,
So how are someone like, you know, Gotham and Sons, you know, how are they going to cope with that, you know?
I don't know what they're doing at the moment. But, I mean, if they are struggling to recruit people from Eastern Europe in particular, which is... where a lot of people have come from in the past, and they won't be alone, because I've certainly got some of my clients, you know, have got issues with recruiting from abroad now. They're not getting as many people coming over, partly because of Brexit, I think. And
that's not because we've turned the tap off. They've just made a conscious decision to say, look, actually, I'm better off working in Germany, for example, because... You know, the kind of the social security
Staying in Europe, and
actually I can drive to Germany in 8 hours and I can go home at the weekend rather than having to be based in the UK and not go home at the weekend, I guess.
And I think some of the economies in these countries have picked up as well, so there isn't the need perhaps for them to come over here as much as there was. But, you know, people have to tackle it in two ways, right? You've got to think about how to recruit people and maybe think about different ways of doing it. Than in the past. So, for example, accommodation, offering accommodation might be something that they have to consider if they don't already.
Well, that would be quite a strong incentive, wouldn't it? Because we've just said that, you know, there is a huge pressure. And then you look at the rental market in this country, you know, property is very expensive to rent, isn't it? So maybe that would be one option.
Subsidising it, perhaps, or providing it for free. Also, you know, obviously... making use of people who are already over here and maybe are offering introductory bonuses to introduce people they know, that sort of thing. Traditional advertising doesn't seem to work much anymore. Online job boards, you know, can be okay, but variable, I suppose. I think employment training providers are quite a good way, actually, of recruiting people, perhaps people who have... maybe been out of the labour market for a while and want to get back into it. They might not necessarily... Well, they might well be from overseas, but not necessarily. So I think we've got to think about doing things differently. We're using social media a lot more as well to publicise vacancies. So there's a few things one can do in terms of recruitment. And then retention, of course, making sure people stay as well and don't go back home perhaps afterwards, you know. So thinking about your employee benefits package as well as your pay rates. Things like health cash plans can be quite a cost-effective way of helping people appreciate, if you like, the value of working for their employer. Things like online shopping portals as well. I even talked to a company the other day about introducing a Christmas savings club. They've got a little bit of a checkered history, I think. But
it'd be nice to think that we could... We could offer people a career in these kind of, you know, historically low-paid agricultural sector kind of, you know, as I say, unskilled, semi-skilled jobs, wouldn't it? It'd be nice that, you know, it clearly is a growing industry.
Hey! See what you did there.
But, you know, as Simon says, I think we need to think about it differently. You know, if this is a huge kind of, you know, growth sector, you know, and we have got a resourcing problem, we need to go about it. We need to think kind of differently, don't we? I think that's the key thing. And that's, you know, that's tied up with all sorts of discussions around the educational system and kind of preparing kids for work and all of that. But it's just a really good news story, isn't it? You know, that as I say, you know, something as simple as an apple, is actually a growing business for a huge fruit producer in our county, and that they've got other manufacturers who are buying that in and actually creating some value out of their own and selling that on, you know, as a fast moving consumer good in a supermarket. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's a really good news story.
Idea,
yeah,
it?
I love it. It's great.
Particularly children, I'd have thought.
Yeah.
You know, actually, you know, looking at a bag of crisps, but finding that it's full of fruit, and actually, hopefully, they're going to like it.
And enjoying it, yeah.
Enjoying it.
So that's a really good one. Mm. Brian, we've probably got time for one more item, haven't we? Do we want to talk about the juxtaposition between sort of retaining heritage and old buildings versus the kind of the demands of the modern day kind of urban planners?
Yeah, that's a good point, Martin, because there is a situation going on like that, similar to that in Ashford at the moment. So there's huge plans afoot to really redevelop Ashford Town Centre, etc., etc. I understand that those plans have now basically ground to a halt because there's a particular building that's in the middle of this planned development. Mm. I believe it was the old Mecca Bingo building or something like that, that they believe now may be Grade 2 listed. So it's kind of everything down tools grinds to a halt and nothing can happen. So, as you said, what should we... It's kind of a bit of a dilemma, isn't it? It's kind of a bit of a battle because you need to kind of push on with redeveloping places like Ashford and many other town centres.
And I mean, let's be clear. You know, there has been a huge amount of new development in Ashford recently. I mean, you've got Curious Brew. You know, you've got the outlet centre kind of expanding. So it's not like this is development per se in Ashford is ground to halt. This is a particular site in Ashford, isn't it? That's got a very old theatre on it. And, and I guess what they're weighing up is whether or not that should be a listed building and whether we should be kind of retaining those kind of buildings as part of our kind of heritage moving forwards, or if we should just bulldoze them in the name of kind of development. And I mean, what are your...
Is there a way we can do both? Because you do need to press on with stuff that's going to bring more people into town centres and keep it vibrant and profitable and everything else. But by the same token, you don't want a kind of a Prince Charles type concrete jungle put up that just looks horrific. And do we just kind of obliterate all of our heritage? Is there a way that you can do both? I'm not sure. What's your view?
I think you've got to keep the old buildings. I mean, you know, just to demolish everything that's old is wrong. But you just wonder, when there's some of the planning point of view, that they didn't realise it's a Grade 2 listed building.
Well, it's not yet. I think that's the problem. It might be, and therefore everything's ground to a halt. Yeah. I think the Cinema Theatre Association are the ones that are kind of calling for it to be.
Stepped in and said we think it should be.
Yeah, but it's I mean, Simon, what do you think? I mean, is there a place for old amongst the new as well?
The City of London, a wonderful place.
There wasn't a leading question, by the way. Looking at you, I mean, we're all of a certain vintage in the studio today. So I didn't mean it. That
he's only 96. Why pick on Simon?
I didn't think you were referring to anything else. No, I think it's great to have the old and the new. Obviously, you know, development has to be sensitive, and I think often it is, and there are plenty of examples where it's worked really well. I would be a great shame to abandon all old buildings.
So to
retain the character of the place as well.
I mean, they can always be repurposed, can't they? I mean, I can't believe they held on to...
You know, use the structure of the building and turn that structure into something rather than just knock it down and put something brand new in its place.
I think often the frontage is the listed bit.
Yes, exactly.
The back of it isn't, actually.
So that was Battersea Power Station, wasn't it, for example? You know, I mean, that whole site just stood empty for so long. And I think, you know, as you say, the outside fabric is being retained, but inside, I think, you know, Apple are going to have their European headquarters there, and you know that finally the whole, you know, it's got some kind of movement there and some energy. So I mean,
the danger is, does it get destroyed in terms of just being left to a point where it's
exactly.
unrepairable, or the cost of repair,
which is
so
worse. I would suggest
just letting something just crumble. That
happens with a lot of buildings, doesn't it? You know, because of that listed status.
And the other squabbling that goes on around it. It's just that's a lose lose, isn't it?
Interesting. Well, I think we'll kind of wrap up the news there. Certainly a lot going on, as always, but some really, really positive stuff happening. I was at the Curious Brew, the Curious Brewery, I should say.
I bet you were.
Curious Brew Brewery last week for an event. And, you know, that's a great example of, again, how you take a very traditional industry like making beer. I mean, it doesn't get much more traditional than that. We used to drink more beer than we did water because it was better for us, you know, in the days of kind of no sanitation. But, you know, that's a great example of how you can just take a very traditional industry and just bring it straight up to date, you know, bang up to date in terms of, you know, creating an experience. around that that people can enjoy. And, you know, I'm all for it. It's wonderful. But, you know, that's a great example of marrying the kind of the very contemporary with something very, very traditional, like making beer.
Hear.
Yeah. So, yeah, onwards. Isn't it nice how we're sort of a complete contrast to South today, you know? Do you ever watch your kind of your local news programme in the evening where it's all doom and gloom?
I'm trying to avoid it for that reason.
You know, I think we need to start a good news TV channel as a kind of a... Maybe, Brian, we should have a conversation about that.
Yeah, we are the good news guys.
We've certainly got a face for radio, but I don't know about TV. So we'll move on. I think what we'll do now is we'll play a bit of music.
Oh.
By way of an introduction to our first guest, and we will
discover if there's any relevance there.
Exactly. We'll let the listener decide what that relevance might be. So bear with, here we go.
You're listening to Kent Biz Connect. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
I did my best to notice when the call came down the line. Up to the platform of surrender, I was brought, but I was kind. And sometimes I get nervous when I see an open door. Close your eyes, clear your eyes.
lion? Are we human or are we dancers? Now,
that's the question.
Enlighten us, please.
Posed by the Killers, in fact. Yeah, I mean, I chose that because it's. I think it's a really good song. I think it's quite nice and flowing and uplifting and everything. And, of course, it's all about, are we human?
People.
People. It's all about people. It's human resources. It's HR.
It must be Simon Morgan HR department.
It's a three-step link to get to Simon. But
sure
we enjoyed
I've heard
it.
That song before. Ah. I'll have to listen to it again. I enjoyed it.
It's Simon. Good, Simon, wasn't it?
Welcome to the studio. It's fair to say that there isn't much you don't know about the world of employment and employment law. So obviously it's a huge area, but where do you think we should start? How should we dive in on this very topical subject? Because of course there's two sides to the coin, aren't there? There's the employer and there's the employee, and I guess you know we often talk about people being an organisation's biggest asset, but are we just kind of paying lip service to that and you know, is the government kind of it needs to tread a fine line, I guess, between being on the side of the individual and being on the side of business. So, How do you juggle that?
Well, you juggle it, I suppose, by having some hopefully fairly straightforward laws governing the world of employment that strike the right balance. But often, of course, they're not. That straightforward, and that is one of the problems. And not only do you have legislation coming around every now and again, but you then have case law where you know judges are basically making decisions in cases that then influence how you interpret the law from then on. So employment law actually is quite a complicated area, and I guess particularly for smaller businesses, you know, it is quite daunting. And often small business owners, you know, may not be sure how to deal with particular situations. They don't want to fall foul of employment law, but they might because they just don't quite understand how to handle something. And so, yeah, I think that's where perhaps small employers, you know, just need to have some knowledge of the rules. You know, they can get that by sort of keeping themselves sort of abreast of what's changing and things like that. I'd say actually employment law has been relatively quiet in the last few years. We haven't had any major changes to employment law, but we have got some changes coming up in April next year that will certainly impact on employers. And
proposed changes, are they?
Yes. You know, the government's still consulting about some of these things, even though we're not that far away from April next year. And, of course, with everything else that's going on, it's not really clear exactly how much if it is going to be coming in April.
Because one of the sort of the main things that happened a couple of years ago, and I've known you for sort of for long enough now to kind of to have understood a bit about this at the time, was the kind of scrapping of tribunal fees. Is that right? And what's been the kind of effect of that in the marketplace from a kind of a an employer being taken to tribunal kind of point of view? Has that had a marked effect or not?
Oh yes, it's had a substantial effect on the number of claims. Yes, as one would have predicted, I suppose. And well, it was considered by some people to be unfair to introduce tribunal fees in the first place, of course. And I think the problem was the government set the fees too high. It was essentially £1,200 to take an employer to court.
So the employee would be paying that?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Unless, I guess, you found a firm of solicitors that would do it on
no-win, no-fee
basis. Yeah. But, yeah, so the burden was on the employee then.
So that lasted a few years, and then after a series of judicial challenges, the Supreme Court decided that actually it wasn't right. It was sort of depriving people of natural justice, so they scrapped them. And we've had fees now since 2017, I think. And what we've had, though, is a very big increase in claims, it's relatively easy to put a tribunal claim in, really. You know, you just fill out a form online.
So if it's not costing you anything, what have you got to lose?
That's
kind
right,
of thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Anybody that's been sacked, basically. Mm. Or...
Well, you have to have 2 years' service to bring a claim for unfair dismissal.
Mm-hmm.
So it does cut out some opportunities, I suppose.
Because that went up from 12 months to 2 years.
Long time ago,
yeah, it's been 2 years for a long while.
Uh-huh. But you get discrimination claims as well, and they don't require any length of service.
Of course.
Now. That's what the impact of that is. That it's actually meant that the tribunals have become clogged up with cases, and now it's taking a significant period of time to actually hear them.
Mm.
So cases are being listed for 12 months and maybe longer. Mm. You know, ahead of time.
Because from a looking at that, from a kind of an employer point of view, and not just that in isolation, but. It's fair to say, I think, that it's a bit of a minefield out there, isn't it? If you are an employer, how do you control what happens in the workplace day to day to avoid, those kind of potential pitfalls? And it doesn't necessarily have to be the employer. It might be, an employee, that has a grievance with another employee because something's happened in the workplace. And you can't possibly control all of those kind of scenarios, can you, as an employer? Or even understand, what the kind of potential ramifications of one thing to the next are. So, you need to be able to call on someone ultimately that can advise you, I would assume, and kind of be objective about it.
Well, I certainly feel that people are... well advised to seek advice, yes, in terms of knowing how to deal with some of these tricky situations that they encounter. And so, for example, I work with small employers, around South East London, North Kent, none of them have got any HR in-house because they're too small. They don't need a permanent resource. But they do come across issues from time to time, and they may only encounter them every now and again, whereas I'm dealing with them all the time. So I can help and guide them through particular issues when they crop up. And as you say, sometimes they're kind of out of their control if they've got disputes between employees, for example. So sometimes I go into a company and help carry out an investigation to find out what actually has happened, to decide then, if you like, what actions should be taken. But I suppose in terms of what can employers really do to minimise the risk of conflict at work, and impacting on their productivity and team morale, etc. And I suppose it's about really trying to create a positive work climate as best you can. And, small employers don't have the resources of larger employers. So it's easy for me to say that.
I read something in the news at the weekend about Facebook, and it was all around the kind of the lack of tax that they've paid again, despite sort of record revenues. But I think they were saying that the average Facebook employee is earning over £117,000 a year.
What?
That's the average. So
Because of sales commission for selling campaigns and stuff.
Well, I've no idea what their workforce looks like or who does what within Facebook in the UK. But that for me is kind of just shows the disparity between what these kind of global multinationals are doing at a kind of an employment level to keep people motivated and interested and all kind of buying into the culture, and it's the old kind of beanbag cliche, isn't it? The ball pit that these kind of these big US corporations have kind of introduced. But it's that kind of culture, isn't it? It's the fridge with the drinks and the free food and you wear what you want to work kind of culture. But the disparity between that and what's going on, with the other half of the economy, which is made up of small and micro and small businesses, who are the other half of the UK economy, and what's going on there kind of day to day, and the reality of, quite often low-ish margin businesses who are still having to, you know, to do exactly the same job in terms of staff retention and motivation and conflict management and everything else, but with a fraction of the kind of resources, I guess. It's not an easy thing to juggle, is it? I mean,
not at all. No, it's a completely different world, obviously, to the world of Facebook. And I think, though, at the end of the day, though, it still comes back to one thing, which is good management.
Mm.
You know, and again, in smaller employers, often people who have got management roles, you know, they haven't had any training particularly. No. They've probably just progressed into a role. Mm. A lot of them, of course, are family businesses. They've been, you know, come into the business because it was the family asset, and you know, they've stayed. And that can be a difficulty sometimes because people genuinely aren't sure how to deal with things when they come up. Mm. What I'm finding certainly now, and I think increasingly so actually, is you are getting more conflict within companies as mm. people, you know, have difficulty with the work, perhaps, you know, pressure of delivering to their targets, etc., and maybe being very stressed as well, and mm. that plays a part.
Mm.
And then, you know, how do you handle people who aren't performing or perhaps have got long periods off sick and things like that?
Mm. I mean, stress is a good one today, isn't it? I mean, you know, I've known a couple of, one business and one individual recently in my private life who have been off work or a business that's had someone that's been off work with a stress-related you know, grievance, and an individual that's done the same. And it's an incredibly difficult thing to manage for an employer, isn't it? Because you still have to, you know, you have to pay these people.
Yeah.
But they're not actually doing a job for you. So I guess the key thing is to identify problems early before it kind of gets to that stage.
And very hard to diagnose as well, I would have thought. So, you know, who's stressed and who yeah. isn't.
Often the stress is also two ways because, you know, the MD or the owner of the business can also be very stressed in situations where there's a conflict, particularly, you know, with perhaps a head of department or somebody, you know, yes. who has a key role within that business. And, you know, I've been dealing with a few situations recently where the relationships have completely broken down, sadly. And then you try and help resolve them if you can so that perhaps people can move on and still work together, but sometimes it actually doesn't
they can't.
Happen like that. So I think trying to ensure that when you get situations like that, you deal with them in the right way, a way that isn't going to end up at a tribunal.
Yes.
And sometimes it means obviously having a discussion with somebody about maybe leaving the business.
Yes.
And you have to just be prepared to accept that, you know, you've got to make some kind of payment.
But I mean, let's be clear, those discussions can be had, but they need to be done in the right way, following the right process. I mean, I remember years ago, was it David Beckham and Alex Ferguson, there was this sort of well-publicised...
kicking the football boot and he ended up with a...
falling eye. Out in the changing rooms, but I guess... You know,
if Alex Ferguson could be that accurate every week, he'd still be in the team.
But I guess for many business owners, it is their business. And, you know, they're not necessarily, as you say... trained in the kind of the subtleties of people management, and so those kind of situations are likely to arise.
Well, I think sometimes, you know, owners are very passionate about their business and they probably have fairly unrealistic expectations sometimes of the people that work for them who are paid obviously probably a lot less,
right?
You know, don't get anything like the benefits that they get, so
right.
You know, engendering, if you like, loyalty and commitment, you know, does take, I think, a lot of skill and hard work.
Mm.
And, you know, when you haven't got the resources of the Facebooks of this world, then yes, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, how do you
do it? One way of doing it is by showing that you appreciate the people that work for you.
Mm-hmm.
So good communications, and I always say this to small employers, actually, think about having an appraisal process because people do value feedback. They do, and a lot of employers don't bother. You know, they just think it's too much hard.
But it's a measurement thing as well, isn't it? Because if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And, you know, people need to know what their targets are, agreed targets and, you know, goals and stuff like that. I mean, one thing I wanted to ask Simon is that how do you find your time is kind of split between employee and employer stuff? Is it is it fairly equal or...?
Well, I very much deal with employers. I help them manage employee issues within their businesses. Obviously, though, having said that, you know, I therefore I don't really advise employees directly at all because I think that would pose a conflict, if you like. Although I know law firms, of course, can wear both hats. You know, as long as people work for different organisations, they don't have any issues at all with dealing with employees and employers. I prefer, bearing in mind I'm not a lawyer and I'm an HR person, I prefer to deal with employers. But a lot of what I do is about conflict with employees. You know, in the old days, if you like, going back a few decades, it would also be collective industrial disputes.
Of course, we don't belong to a union.
So now it doesn't tend to be collective, it's more individual. And unions don't really have much of a role now, especially in the small business world anyway.
I think they still do in the public sector, don't they? I think the unions are still you know, quite strong in the public sector.
And I think there's nothing wrong with a person being in a union because you never know, if you ever get into a difficulty, you might want someone to help you help your case, you know, to represent you. And you can certainly be represented by an individual union representative, even if you know, the company doesn't sort of you know, recognize you for sort of collective bargaining purposes or anything.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I've certainly had a lot of feedback with our own networking group with BBN, and I know that quite a few of the employers there have said to me, Simon's been phenomenally helpful with some disputes that we had or some scenarios that we had, and we didn't really know where to go with it and we didn't know what the answer was, and Simon successfully advised and kind of brought it to a satisfactory conclusion.
But going back to what you were talking about there, you know, appraisals are all well and good, you know, in terms of, you know, taking note of individuals' performance within an organisation and setting objectives and everything else. But, I mean, surely that's only kind of half the story, isn't it? I mean, do people need to know where the organisation is going? You know, do they need to kind of buy into the culture, the philosophy, the kind of the, you know, the ethos, you know, all these kind of very difficult to articulate things in the kind of small business space? Is that an important motivator?
I think it is, yes. I think everybody wants to know how they are contributing to the success of that organisation. And that's where, you know, appraisals have got a role to play, because your own objectives and the expectations upon you, what you do is in your job, you know, should be, it should be obvious to you, really, how you're contributing to the business.
Right, so that must be linked to the bigger picture.
Because
there's that thing about the, and I don't know whether this story was true or not, but it's certainly often quoted. It was the, I think it was Kennedy, was he walking around the Space Centre in, you know, Cape Canaveral or wherever it was, you know, the NASA kind of HQ back in the 60s, having kind of put his stall out and said, we will put a man on the moon this decade. And then he was walking around the, you know, the Space Centre, and he spoke to the janitor, and he, I don't, you probably know the story better than me. I think he said to him, you know, and what's your job, Sonny, you know? And the guy said, well, my job is to help put the man, you know, put a man on the moon.
That's right, yeah.
And that's incredibly powerful, isn't it? Because that says to me, it doesn't matter who you are in the kind of the hierarchy of an organisation, if you can kind of create a culture where everybody understands what, you know, why they go to work every day, then, you know, that's the nirvana, isn't it? That's what you're trying to achieve. Is that right, or is that just completely nonsensical?
That's an example from a long time ago, and the fact that you're quoting it now and people recognise it, you know, it speaks volumes, actually. Very powerful image, if you like, of someone in a very junior role associating his own role with actually the whole purpose of the organisation.
I think people really do want to feel that they are making a contribution, and you know, knowing what it is,
mm-hmm.
and having appreciation shown for how you are contributing,
mm-hmm.
and being rewarded as well. I mean, all right, there's an element of financial reward, of course, that's got to be there, but in other ways as well. Mm. You know, just knowing that you know people think you're doing a good job, mm. And so on,
mm-hmm.
and conveying that. And I think communications is also often underestimated. People always say, oh, we haven't got time to have a team meeting or something like that, you know. And it's often a false economy because, you know, without that sort of opportunity for people to get together and have some kind of input into discussions about the business and how it's going, and receiving information about how the business is going and therefore feeling part of it, you know, you lose that a sense of people contributing to the overall team. So people should, I think, make time for appraisals and make time for communications meetings. And those are a couple of fairly simple things to do, really. They shouldn't take up too much time, and people value it.
So in an ideal world, that's how you like to work with employers on that basis. You know, if they have a high staff turnover, for example, and they're a business that's continually, you know, needing to call on your services to sort out problems, you know, it's kind of flipping that on its head and saying, look, how can we actually approach this more positively in terms of, you know, avoiding issues like this moving forward? And that's your kind of ideal scenario, I guess.
Well, a lot of time, obviously, I'm advising on how to deal with individual situations. But yes, I'll often extend that afterwards, if you like, to say, well, you know, there are other things that you could be doing as, as a business here to help ensure these kinds of things don't happen again.
But it's not an easy environment for employers today, is it? I mean, we talk about you know, regulation and employment law, and it's becoming more and more detailed, if you like, and complicated. I read something somewhere recently, Simon, about I mean, we've talked about sort of parental leave. You know, obviously it was maternity leave.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that,
and now it's paternity leave.
Because that never used to happen in my day, paternity leave.
But now we're in the situation where, you know, we're talking about potentially, I read in the news, giving people time off for pet bereavement.
Oh.
And, you know, and we all know how traumatic it is when you lose a family pet. I mean, it's horrible. It's devastating. But, you know, should the employer be asked to kind of shoulder that financial burden and lose somebody out of the business for a day for something like that? I mean, where do you draw the line, Simon? You know, where's this all going to end?
Well, I think you could say an employer that understands how that bereavement of that pet has impacted upon the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Might well be very sympathetic and allow that person to have some time off anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably, you know, caring employers would do that. I think there's nothing wrong with doing that. If we end up with a law or something that says, you know, you can have a day or two or what have you for a pet bereavement.
A budgie day.
I think in a way that's kind of indicating that we've not been able to actually manage something like that ourselves. We've had to have a law. I mean, there's no law about bereavement leave for a person, actually. I mean, it's encouraged that people would get compassionate leave if they lose a close relative or family member. And that seems to work quite well. So perhaps that's what will happen with pets as well.
Yeah.
But I think that the law is there to provide a framework, if you like, and not to get too prescriptive.
No.
That's the key, really. Mm-hmm. We have got quite a lot of uncertainty around things like employment status at the moment, and you know whether people are really employees or not, and things like that.
And they have self-employed and
self-employed, and they've been looking at this. They've been looking at this, and they are going to introduce some changes next year to try and help give greater clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can say is I hope that is what it does, and it doesn't actually bring about more complexity.
Mm.
But one particular change that's coming in, which I think would be of interest to any employer who particularly hasn't got any written contracts in place at the moment, is that from April next year, people will be expected to have been issued with a
statement of written terms and conditions on day one of their employment. At the moment, you have up to 2 months to provide some sort of written statement, and it only applies to employees, and it's going to apply to workers as well, this other category, if you like, of person that works for a company. Workers are not self-employed, but they actually embrace more people than just employees. So I would urge any employer out there who hasn't issued, you know, written statements of terms and conditions to consider that.
You're talking.
That seems crazy to me because you could actually be doing the wrong job for 2 months, then, couldn't you? Or have a completely misunderstanding of what you were supposed to be doing.
Well, but you've called them terms and conditions. You know, that's not a contract of employment.
Well, it's most of it usually. Okay, yeah. It's most of it. Yes, yeah. But yes, a contract can be more than just a written statement of terms and conditions. The law actually prescribes what kind of things you put in a written statement.
Mm.
But to all intents and purposes, think of it as a written contract.
Yes.
To all intents and purposes. And the reason
I don't like that word terms and conditions. For me, that implies commoditization.
Mm.
You know, that implies a sort of, you know, I buy something from Amazon and it doesn't work and I send it back. You know, it's and I'd hate for us to kind of get to a point where, and this gig economy thing is a grey area, isn't it? Where we kind of, we view people as purely as commodities. Mm.
But to pick up Brian's point, that's why you have them, so that you actually reduce the risk of uncertainty and confusion and obviously disputes about what actually your job is all about or how you're going to be rewarded for doing it. So you know, written statements, you know, include things like setting out what your pay rate is and how often you're paid and when you're paid, what your hours of work are,
all the basics
and holidays. So I don't think too many people would dispute that's information that, you know, ought to be recorded in writing, and they ought to be clear about what they actually are getting.
Absolutely.
So
and that's a good thing for the worker or the employee, not a bad thing.
I think that's very the appraisal thing as well, isn't it? Because, you know, if you don't know what you're supposed to do, you don't know what the employer expects from you. So how do you know how you do it? You've got no way of measuring it, have you?
Absolutely. And we could talk all day about this. It's a fascinating area. I think it's only going to become more and more detailed and more complex as time moves on. In other words, if you have any questions whatsoever,
we're going to need you more and more, Simon,
about
the sound of it.
what you should or shouldn't be doing as a conscientious employer, we need to talk to you, Simon. That's the key kind of message here. And frankly, you know, without an extensive kind of human resource dedicated to HR within a business, frankly, I don't know how any employer manages to get by anyway without being able to call on someone like you. So how do we get in touch with you?
Well, people can contact me or my colleague by email and also by Twitter and all the various social media. So
you're at HR Rescuer on the Twitter.
That's it, at HR Rescuer.
Yeah.
My email address is simon.morgan@hrdept.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if people want to find out more about us on our website,
go to
www.hrdept.co.uk and look for South East London and North Kent. And you'll see a website there with all sorts of information about me and my colleagues and
Rachel and Hannah.
Services, that's right, the services that we provide to small employers in Kent. And we can deliver those via an annual contract if people want that, to have us available as and when they need to, or on a pay-as-you-go basis, just for one-off pieces of work if necessary.
Perfect.
Brilliant. We look forward to hearing more from people who are concerned about doing the right thing. And with all these changes coming into next year, we will be running some free seminars as well early in the new year, so that if people look out for those on social media and so on and come along, we'll tell you all about what's
going on. Talk to him in person every other Thursday at BBN Dartford, of course.
Indeed. Simon, for now, thank you so much for coming on. And Brian, I think what we're going to do is play a bit more music, by way of an introduction to our next guest, Neil Page, and we'll join you on the other side of this.
Oh yes.
Welcome back to the show, and Brian, it's fair to say, another huge Great British success story there in Depeche Mode.
Another classic.
Big in Japan, I think, Depeche Mode in their day, huge in Japan. But tell us, what is the link between Depeche Mode, People Are People, and our next guest?
So why should it be? You and I should get along so awkwardly. Yeah, it is exactly that. It's the clue is in the line. People are people, and we're in the people business, and pretty much so is our next guest, Neil. So he's all about people, and he's a person as well himself. Of course, so.
Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You've got two hats on today.
I have.
The first hat we're going to wear is obviously the Active Business Group,
which is
a networking group that you chair on a weekly basis. But we'll then come on to talk about the second hat that you're going to be wearing today, which is obviously Horizon Vehicle Leasing. But let's start with Active Business Group. Tell us in your own words, who are Active Business Group? What's it all about?
Yeah, let's talk a bit of networking.
A bit of networking. Well, as one of my old sales reps used to say, people do business with people.
Absolutely.
And I think that's very true. And, you know, people like to sort of meet who they want to do business with. And the Active Business Group is all part of that, meeting people. I mean, we're a group of people. We're sort of hardworking professionals, we like to think. Tradespeople, service industries. We meet once a a week at the Boughton Golf Club in Faversham. Mm-hmm. And we have a networking meeting, a bit of breakfast. And it's all about meeting people, getting to know people and doing business with those people.
Mm-hmm. But also supporting people, I think
it is.
Fair to
it
say,
is very
it?
Much, you know. And we're a completely independent group. We're not linked to any other networking group or sort of major sort of business that there are and doing that sort of thing. And as a result, you know, all the money that we generate from the for the cost of the subs and that sort of thing mm-hmm. is put back into the business. Mm-hmm. And we're there really to sort of help and advise the other members of the business where we can help in terms of looking at what we do. Experiences we've had, whether it be something to do with HR or something where mm-hmm. where somebody might have had an issue and they can talk to somebody else mm. and say, well, look, guy, how did you deal with that? Mm. And we've got an accountant as part of the group, and it might be that they're not necessarily our accountant, but we can go to them and say, well, what about doing this and that? We've done this, and what do you think? And that mm. type of thing. So it very much is about mm. that help, that advice,
yes.
And a, you know, a group of people that, that get on very well, that sort of meet, that help each other grow their businesses, mm. not just by sort of that referral process, which, you know, we do a lot within the group, and obviously that helps, but it's also about sort of offering sort of services, if you like, and we, what we also do is sort of bring in services where we've had people that, that do certain things. We've got a videographer. Mm-hmm. And what we did as a group was to arrange a discounted price for some videos which we generated. Of, you know, whereas you'd normally pay quite a substantial price for mm-hmm. that, doing it individually, doing it as a group meant we could do it in one place, reduce the overall cost, and the group helped to subsidise that, mm, which meant that we could all have, you know, even small sort of one-man band businesses could have a small video which would appear on their website, would appear on the ABG website, and, you know, that helped to generate sort of interest, Facebook and various different sort of social media formats, and that all helps to sort of attract, you know, in terms of the Google rankings, all that sort of thing. So it's something that we can do as a group mm-hmm. to help businesses from outside really mm-hmm. Grow their business from different mm-hmm. Areas rather than just within the group.
Mm. So mm. you pay a subscription to, mm-hmm. to become part of the group. What are the, I mean, what are the annual subs? What is that? I think it's a couple of hundred quid a year.
Yeah, I think it's 125 we charge now, and it's about yeah. sort of, I think we do it in different ways. You can do sort of a £75 a month as part of, to join the group and yeah. include your sort of annual fee or pay that up front and pay a sort of a monthly fee with the reduced yes. cost, but the overall cost is thereabouts
yeah.
the same.
But that would include your brekkie, yeah.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
But the advantage there clearly is that you're going to benefit from some of that money coming back to you in the form of, you know, training or discounted offers or
exactly,
whatever it
yeah.
might be.
I mean, you know, as I say, you're right in that, you know, we pay for the room rent and we pay for the breakfast, but mm-hmm. any money that's generated from the income from the group mm-hmm. is put back into the group.
Yes.
You know, we don't have any shareholders. We mm-hmm. don't have any sort of other sort of business that we're paying, anything like that. Mm-hmm. So all the money it goes right back into the group. Mm-hmm. And you're right, and it helps to do sort of social events sometimes. Mm-hmm. It helps to do the sort of business things. Mm-hmm. And
off-site as well, don't you? I mean, you visit other members' premises, for example. I think you were at your accounting company member recently, weren't you, a few weeks back?
That's right. I mean, again, it's
what
all part of...
What happens there, then? How does that work?
It's all really part of, you know, if someone wants to show really what they do, mm-hmm. give us a feel for how their business works, and you know, because mm-hmm. you can talk to people, but mm-hmm. to actually sit in their business yes. and understand what they do is quite a powerful thing, mm-hmm. to meet their members of staff, and that's sort of thing mm-hmm. is really good, and it's always a good news story. I mean, you're right, we did go and see the lady who runs the accounting Achieving Clarity mm-hmm. Business, and to actually go and see how she's moved her business on from literally working in a shed in the garden when she first started. It literally was a shed in the garden, to having two sheds in the garden, to now getting to a, you know, it's an office that you know, they're very proud of, which they've sort of got people in, and for her to talk about her business and how it's grown and how they've now got employees and that sort of thing is a really powerful
yes,
thing to
I
see
agree.
How someone has grown their business. Mm. You know, part of it from being part of the group, but obviously some of it doing what they've done and helped, you know, they've developed and moved on and how they've grown. And that's really interesting to sort of go and see those businesses.
Yes.
And when you go and talk to a business and sit down and see what they do, and they can show you things that they do and how it works and get a feel for their office. You get really do get a better understanding of exactly their
business.
And that
is fundamental, isn't it? Because a 60 seconds is just
huge.
That.
Huge.
It's 60 seconds. But if you actually spend the time sitting down with someone and as you say, ideally, you know, understanding their business on that level is so much more powerful, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, we all want to be able to refer businesses that we know are going to do a cracking job for someone.
Oh, exactly.
There's worse than recommending someone who then doesn't deliver.
There's no way you can do that.
And it comes back on you, doesn't it, straight away?
Yeah.
So that gives you that kind of peace of mind, that reassurance that, well, actually, I know their business, you know, because I've been there and I know the people that work there.
It is very powerful in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, I think Neil and I have already found some fairly kind of common agreeances, if you like, on networking. Yeah. And I think that's really important what you've said. And some networking groups have this kind of lockout thing where they will only allow. I'm assuming you don't do that, Neil.
To be fair, we do, from the point of view that what we don't want is necessarily cause a conflict within the group, you know, where we say, you know, we'd only really want sort of one electrician, one plumber, that type of thing. So yes, we do sort of lock out people from the point of view that, you know, you want to actually sort of grow that relationship with that person. I mean, we don't want that sort of conflict, if you like, that can be in the group, and see if there are two accountants, for argument's sake.
So
we do have that, where we allow sort of one member from a thing, but we'd always talk to all the members. So if someone wants to join and we think there might be some crossover, we'll talk to the members and make sure that they're happy that person doesn't sort of conflict. Because what you don't want to do is someone coming on sort of one sort of business which turned into something different, if you like. But so we do operate sort of a lockout basis, but we talk to the members in terms of whether they're happy that if someone does something that does sort of overlap, that sort of one person will do something different. When we've got some people that do overlap in their businesses, but they, you know, they're happy that, you know, that's not really a big part of my business, I'm happy for some to do that, because actually they can refer business then. And you do find that there are some.
So you run your meetings in Faversham.
I think
you've got kind of 20 oddish.
We've got 22 members currently, and it does go up and does go down from time to time. Mm-hmm. You know, we're always looking for new members in a, you know, variety of different categories and that sort of thing.
So the meetings are in Faversham. Is it predominantly for Faversham based businesses? Do you like to get them within a kind of 10 mile radius, or?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm based in Ashford, so for me, I probably travel one of the furthest, but a lot of people, Whitstable, Canterbury, the other side of Canterbury, you know, so it is a quite broad range in terms of the area, and we're happy to take businesses that are not necessarily in Faversham, but it just happens to be where we meet.
Thanet, I mean, you've got businesses from Thanet, Jackie's over Hursdon Way, isn't she?
That's right, yeah, so it is quite wide area of Kent.
But it is more sort of East Kent kind of focused, isn't
it? I mean, yeah.
Because it always...
North, yeah.
People have always
They'll
got
come
that.
Up, won't they? But not a lot of people kind of go down,
exactly.
as it were.
Yeah. So that makes sense from that point of view. But the thing that kind of really impressed me, because I came along recently, and we should let people know that you do a free breakfast offer
don't
you? You offer people a couple of opportunities to come along.
Because we want to encourage people to come along, we want to, you know, encourage people to see what we're all about and experience it. We allow people to come twice, and we pay for the breakfast, so it's no cost to the business, for their business, to come and see us, come and chat to us, see what we're all about, and hopefully they'll like what they see and join us.
And that's outside of visitor days that you run as well, because you run those alongside as well. And I've been to a couple of those, and they're incredibly popular with people, and they're always kind of oversubscribed on the day as well.
We often get sort of 50 people plus at visitors days, and it is really a good event, because what we try and do is make it, rather than just sort of come along and join us, but we make it interesting and try and add a bit of value and get a speaker along if we can and that sort of thing to actually make it sort of interesting.
And as an event in its own right, as opposed to, you know, a networking visitor.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and again, we don't charge people for those events as well. So, the aim is to really encourage people to see what we're all about free of charge, and hopefully, you know, if they like what they see and join us, great, all the better.
But what I liked really recently when I came along was, obviously you have your kind of your 60-second format, if you like.
I was going to ask what's the format.
But it's much more than that, because you invite people to kind of share some positives and negatives, don't you, on the day as well. And that's an opportunity for people to put their hand up and say, you know, I've got this issue or I've encountered this problem. And then others can kind of, join in on that discussion and maybe find a way through that.
We call it a 60 seconds, but rarely is it ever 60 seconds. Mm. Some people, you know, are not that comfortable speaking, and they, you know, they'll do 30 seconds because that's what they like to do. Yeah. Some people will go on for 10 minutes, you know, it depends.
Does that result in a rather late breakfast?
It can do, yeah. We tend to have breakfast first and then get... Yes. But we don't sort of time people and say, right, you've got 60 seconds and that's it, and cut them off. You know, as you say, some people do have issues they want to talk about, or maybe they'll just be chatting about what they're doing, or they're finding certain things that are working, or they just want a bit of advice and say, well, actually, this is what I've been doing, but, you know, what do the rest of the group think? And, you know, we make it a very open meeting, and it's not a sort of closed 60 seconds, that's it, move on and done. You know, we like to encourage people to talk, to, you know, tell us what's been going on. It's that the format is loose in the respect that, you know, we try and keep it sort of to a sort of particular format, but equally we'll sort of change it up a bit and say, right, what's happening? We'll encourage members to do a 10-minute presentation or longer, with some slides, because that really does help. Because when people say what they do, and they tend to get into a format that, you know, I do this, I do this, I do that, and then outside of that, sometimes you might find that, oh, you know, if I talk about my business in a lot more detail, I do this, this and this. And you think, oh, I didn't know you did that. You know, we had the printer that I was talking to. And, you know, you think the printer does, you know, the printed page, but actually they do signage boards. They do, you know, things that all sorts of bits and pieces they can do. So display stands, and you think, oh, I didn't realise you did that. And you know, that person I've known for a couple of years or whatever, and then you suddenly find, oh, you do something which I didn't realise that a 10-minute presentation or a visit to their site will actually show you. So I think all that's a really good to,
and you can
to
get
really
to know them a lot better as well as people.
That for me is the key to sort of successful networking in many ways. It's understanding at a deeper level, you know, outside of I've listened to you for a minute and, you know, I don't really know what you do. So therefore, you know, you're not on my radar
But we also do a lot of social events as well. I mean, we've just come back on Friday. We had the Bateau down the Thames, where a big group of us went down the Thames on a meal and had a bit of wine and, you know, entertainment on board. And all those sort of things help develop that bond and that relationship between all the members of the group. And we find that, again, you know, very powerful in terms of getting to know people, understanding them. We tend to run, you know, a few events a year.
You've got a brewery trip coming up this side of Christmas.
We have, which I'm looking forward to.
At Shepherd Neame Brewery in Birmingham.
Yeah, Christmas do is going to be at Shepherd Neame Brewery. So, yes, we've just sorted that out. So that's going to be entertaining.
Good.
But that's all part of the group, really. That's part of, you know, being that sort of friendly group, which it's not just a, you know, here's what we do, networking, then we go away and live different lives. We sort of integrate and do stuff, and that's how you grow your relationship with those people and that trust and eventually that sort of business that we do.
And you're not, as you say, you're all about relationships and collaboration as opposed to, you know, numbers. And kind of red slips and, you know, which kind of sets you apart, I think.
Yeah, we're not a transactional sort of business. You know, we do note how much business that we pass around the group because we want to know what's happening, you know, but it's not about that. You know, I've done this, I've done that. We do have a slot that we do, not every week, but from, you know, week to week, we'll ask, you know, any particular referrals or that people want to mention. And, you know, when someone's done a good job, someone's helped me out here, someone's installed that,
but that will be self-evident anyway. It's not something that, you know, that has to be that has to adhere to any particular format.
We're not about saying, oh, what have you done? What have you done? How much have you given? That's not how we work, because there will be some trades that do a lot of business together because of the nature of what they do. But there will be others that don't particularly do much business together, but they'll do bits of business here and there. So, you know, it's unfair to say that, oh, this particular person hasn't given much business.
Yes. When single them out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's not what we're about at all.
Ask them to leave the group.
How much have you done?
Yeah. It was funny because at BBM Maidstone on Friday, we had three or four, in fact, five brand new people that came, first-time attendees. And the ones that get there early, really early, are like the tradie-type people. Mm. So we've got a builder, a plasterer, a pest control guy, an electrician, a kitchen fitter, a pressure washer guy, and they're there, you know, before I get there, generally. And they've all kind of sat on the same table. And one of the new guys got there really early. He's a financial advisor, come up from Canterbury, and he went to sit there. And I said, oh, I wouldn't sit there if I was you. That's the kind of down and dirty, mucky table. It's all the tradie guys sitting there. But it's interesting because, as you say, Neil, it's like a little mini power team, and they can all hook up with each other and do stuff like that, which is brilliant. So we got a smutty end now at the end. Yeah. So, all the tradie types, all you manual chappies. Mm.
Everybody likes to do things in a certain way, and I think the beauty again of a of the marketplace, the networking space, is that, you know, there are all sorts of different organisations catering for all sorts of different preferences. You know, it's not for us to say one thing is right and something else is wrong. It's just, in fact, many people combine lots of different ways of
going about. Oh, they do. People go for different reasons as well.
Yeah. So,
many of our members will go to, you know, not just the active business group, but they'll go to other sort of networking groups.
Of course.
And, you know, well, you don't have any issue with that. No. That's absolutely fine. That's the way of the world. And, that's one of the reasons that we get a free breakfast two free breakfasts for any visitors, is to encourage people to come along and see what we're about. No obligation.
Which I think is key. Yeah. So tell us on that basis, how do we do that? How do we kind of put our hand up and say, Neil, I'd like to come along for a breakfast to see what you guys are all about?
The easiest way, to be fair, is to go onto our website, which is Active Business Group, and you'll see there's details on there about guests come along to a meeting. You just put your details, name and address and email, and just say, I'd like to come along to a meeting, and say what particular day. It's every Tuesday at the Boughton Golf Club. Mm-hmm. It runs from about 7 o'clock to about 8:30. Just more than welcome to come along. Just go to the website.
I think I might come for three free
breakfast.
I think you should,
Brian. It's on a Tuesday. It doesn't clash with anything you go to.
No, I've got Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. Right.
We're fast running out of time. We have got 3 minutes left. We're going to rather condense your second hat. It's more of a fez than a top hat, I would suggest.
Not like that.
So tell us about Horizon, because obviously you are an active business group member.
I am.
But as Horizon Vehicle Leasing.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's my business. We're a vehicle broker. What we do is cars, commercial vehicles. We find and then fund them in a variety of different ways. It might be a purchase, might be a lease, might be finance lease, PCPs, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And we do that for individuals. We do that for businesses and, you know, for all makes or models of vehicles, whether it be a car, commercial vehicle, van, pickup, all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And really that's my business. That's what we do. And I'm one of the three directors of that business. And, that's the business I represent with the Active Business Group.
And you're 5 years in that business.
We are,
so it's fair to say that, you know, again, as, like with Simon, it's probably not an awful lot you don't know about the kind of vehicle leasing marketplace.
Well, we like to think
so.
I mean, you know, my experience was sort of 17 years in the finance and leasing industry for people like Lombard, Bank of Scotland. The other guys have experience of working in dealerships, working for manufacturers, that sort of thing. So, you know, we've got probably about 70, 80 years worth of experience between us all in the motor trade in one way, shape or form. And, you know, we use that experience to talk to people, to help them, to find the best deals and to sit down with people and discuss what their requirements are, how we can best help and you know, move their business on, if you like, with the vehicles that they want to look at.
And your whole of market, so you're not tied to, you know, a particular manufacturer or anything like that, you know.
No, that's right. You know, and we can look at things where, you know, you might go into a dealership and say, well, I'm looking at a Mercedes or whatever it might be. We can say, well, have a look at that Mercedes board about a BMW, an Audi or whatever it might be, you know, and particularly with things like the development, the electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, we're talking to all sorts of people, and obviously Tesla and you know, onto the market and lots of things going on there. Mm-hmm. You know, we had them come in to see us a couple of weeks ago with a vehicle and talk to us about that marketplace. And that's an extremely interesting marketplace at the moment. And obviously a developing marketplace with you know, electric vehicles, you know, high on the agenda at the moment. Lots of people looking at and thinking about them. So, you know, it's an area where we're talking to a lot of people about at the moment. And we you know, help people through that minefield. You know, there's a lot of indecision about what to do. Mm-hmm. What's the best vehicles? Is diesel still relevant? Should I be looking at that? Should I be looking at petrol, hybrid, electric? And it's you it's really looking that at that market
as well. So on that basis, how do we get in touch with you at Horizon?
That will be our website, which is www.horizonvehicleleasing.co.uk. Give us a call, 01233 754 800, or our Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn presence.
You're everywhere. Good. Yeah. All right. Fabulous. Neil, thank you so much for now. I think we need to get you on again to talk more in detail about Horizon at some point, so we will do that. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with two more fabulous guests, but for now, thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in to the show, and we'll be back shortly. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye for now.